3. James chapter 3. How many have ever had to have an occasion to call animal control out to your house for or neighborhood or whatever? Maybe it's you have a wild animal stuck in your attic, or a stray dog running around, or whatever. We had such an occasion one time, and I think I may have shared this with you before, that we had to call animal control because we had a critter in our attic, and. In the middle of the night is when it, because it was a nocturnal animal, it wanted to come alive and play in our attic at night. And so it would crawl, you could hear it crawling up, and then it felt like it was dragging something, and crawl, 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 drag, crawl, 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 drag, and we could just, it was like really, really weird. And so finally we called pest control, and they came out and went down into the, got up into the attic and set a trap. And as he's setting the trap, he looks over in the corner, and there is the raccoon staring at him, setting the trap. And so, needless to say, he didn't take the bait, and I waited until he was out of the attic during the day when he came out to do something. I don't know if he just went out to get food or whatever, but I knew he was out of the house, out of the attic, and I sealed up the hole that he was in, and so he never got back into our attic. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know. Wild animals, you know, can prowl around, and you can have instances like we did where we had to call animal control to come out. And, you know, all you have to do is just pick up the phone and call Lane County Animal Control, and they'll round it up and haul it out, you know, in most cases. In our case, we had to outsmart it ourselves. But, you know, we can round up and haul off these wild and roaming animals. So why is it that we don't have a catcher and a pound for stray words? I mean, can you imagine the money that you could make if you could be a word catcher? You travel around and you could snatch those words. Let's make it personal. Let's say you're sitting at home and you're resting and watching TV, and suddenly you'd had a real hard day at work, and suddenly the doorbell rings, and you're met with somebody who says, "Excuse me, sir, but does this word belong to you? We caught it running loose out on I-5, and it chewed up a lot of folks. And your neighbor said that it sounded a lot like your word." So you take a long look at that word, and you kind of say, "Sure enough, I let that gossip out on Wednesday." And red-faced, you claim your nasty little word, and you send the word catcher on their way. Now, of course, we don't have word catchers. It's not a real vocation. Unfortunately, it's not. It's an imaginary profession. But I imagine that if you could find a way to round up and return people's words in time to stop the damage, you would have quite a lucrative business on your hands, and especially in our culture of unrestrained tongues. I know I've let some words escape my mouth that I would have paid big bucks to get them back. And I'm sure you have too. Well, things haven't really changed much in the 2,000 or so years since James wrote this letter. In fact, the tongue was of such great concern to James that he not only mentioned it in every chapter of his letter, in every chapter of of this letter that he wrote, but also in chapter 3, he devotes 12 verses to it. 12 full verses to it. And so as we continue in what we would call chapter 6 of the book Christianity for Dummies, and in this chapter James is going to warn us about the dangers of the untamable beast. The untamable beast. And that's that wily little critter that God in his infinite wisdom put in a cage. You know, behind our teeth, walled in by our mouth. He put that tongue in that cage. And James gives us 4 compelling reasons to keep our tongue caged up and under control. Okay, the first thing we do, we're going to talk about four issues here, and the first one we're going to talk about is a diffuse problem, okay? Look at verses 1 and 2. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment, for we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. You know, I think if we're honest, at first glance, we have no idea or no clue why James throws in that first verse, or those first two verses, where he does. They seem kind of out of place, almost lost, you know. But when we consider the context of the first century church, we see how these first two verses become a natural springboard for a discussion about the tongue. You know, in first century society, few could read, and people in lower classes had fewer opportunities for advancement in their status. Prestige and honor was bestowed upon those who were educated, upon the teachers in the first century church. Worship services were dynamic and unstructured. Men were allowed opportunity to stand up and address the rest of the assembly. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 26 and then verse 40, says this. 1 Corinthians 14:26. How is it then, brethren, when you come together, each of you has a psalm. I'm having a little competition for my granddaughter this morning. Each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue. You don't have to take her out. It's okay. Has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. And then skipping down to verse 40, we see that verse that we really need to live by. It says, let all things be done decently and in order. So, you know, we see the tendency of a large section of the church to want to speak during worship. And Christians attracted to teaching and the teaching ministry, albeit sometimes for the wrong reasons. So James, in response, says, hey, cool your jets. You know, don't be in a rush to become a teacher. For you know that he who becomes a teacher will be judged with greater strictness. I had a conversation with a young man a while back about he had a real desire to be in ministry. And I said, well, there are some things in your life that you need to clean up. Because those of us who are teachers, those of us who are in leadership in the church, have a higher responsibility. We have a higher expectation. You might be free to sit in a church and not do anything and do the things you're doing because of the grace of God. But if you're going to be a leader, and especially if you're going to be a leader in this church, you're going to clean a few things up. Well, he's not in our church right now, so you know that. You know, he chose to do some other things. James is not intending to try to discourage teachers, you know. But he is trying to warn of the role of a teacher and the seriousness and of entering it, especially for frivolous reasons or selfish reasons. Particularly in light of what he's about to point out. For we all stumble in many things, and if anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. Now, the teacher puts himself in greater danger of judgment because of the main tool of his ministry. Is also the part of the body that is the most difficult to control. For we all stumble, he said. James first acknowledges the diffuse prevalence of sin. Ecclesiastes 7:20, you know, tells us, he says, surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. 1 Kings 8:46 says, for there is no one who does not sin. 1 John 1:8 says, if anyone says he has no sin, the truth is not in. He lies, and the truth is not in us. Remember what we said about trials and temptation in like the first or second week of this? They're like Skittles, you know, a rainbow of fruit colors, and it's the same way with sin. There are all sorts of sin, but yet sin is sin. See, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. You see, the Greek word for perfect is teleos, meaning complete. Understand, please. He's talking about spiritual maturity, not sinless perfection. Okay? There's only been one human master of the tongue, and his name was and is Jesus Christ. And James is warning, and his warning to would-be teachers has brought to the forefront of his mind the problem of the tongue, a problem for everyone in the church. And then he says, able to bridle his whole body. One theologian pointed this out. It says this, so difficult is the mouth to control, so given it is to utter the false, the biting, the slanderous word, so prone to stay open when it were more profitably closed, that the person who has it in control surely has the ability to conquer other less unruly members of the body. Think about it like this. There was three preachers went on a fishing trip, and they weren't catching many fish. So one preacher decided that, let's confess to one another which is our most trying sin, the thing that we struggle with the most, and then we can pray with each other about it. And so they all agreed to it, and the first one says, well, I got to tell you, he says, my biggest sin and my biggest area of struggle is I like to go to the beach and watch the pretty girls go by. You know, and the others go, well, I understand. And the second preacher's confessed, and he says, well, I like to go out to the racetrack and put a few bets on the ponies, you know. I like to do that. And so they kind of. And then the third guy, they turned to the third guy, and they said, well, what's your biggest sin? And he kind of had a grin on his face, and he says, gossip. That's where my daughter would say in about 10 minutes, oh, I get it. That's pretty quick. The truth be told, the biggest sin in the lives of every one of us in this church this morning is this. It's a diffuse problem in our lives, in our churches, in our homes, in our workplaces, in our schools, in our communities, in our world. You see, the first step to control the tongue is to recognize that fact and honestly and sincerely listen to the words that we are unleashing daily. That's the first step, is recognizing it. Number two, it's disproportionate power. The next three verses, 3, 4, and 5. Look at verses 3 through 5. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder, wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. With the diffuse problem and of the tongue now at the forefront of his mind, James now sets forth a series of illustrations, 4 in fact, that portray the disproportionate power of the tongue. In each illustration, we see a contrast between a small instrument and a large object that it controls. And the first one he talks about is bits in horses, okay? And any of us who have ever ridden a horse implicitly understand how a small thing, a bit, controls a large animal, a horse. I do have a cute little story about we took our youth group when we were in Colorado Springs out to a ranch, and we were all having a good time taking turns riding horses. And there was this one horse, they say, stay away from this horse because he has a mind of his own. And so this one real macho kid in our youth group says, oh, I can write it, you know. And so they said, fine. So the thing, he starts writing it, and the thing had a, the horse had a habit of, when you'd be going along in one direction, it would just, without warning, veer off and change directions. And a lot of people, an inexperienced rider, would go flying off and fall. Well, this kid, he navigated through that part, but then the horse decided it had enough, so then it headed back to the barn. And the barn had a really low doorway, and inside was all of these beams inside, and so he went in, and boom, 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 boom. We could hear his head go, boom, 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 boom. And it comes out kind of like this, and we said, yeah, yeah, you can handle it all right. For most of us, we were smart enough to ride the horses that really obeyed when you gave the slight tug to the left or the slight tug to the right, and it would follow the instruction that the bit, or that you were given it by means of the bit. It controls a large animal. The next thing he talked about was rudders and ships. The Greco-Roman world had large ships, and Paul had been aboard a grain ship that carried like 276 passengers plus all of the cargo. The historian Josephus records that he was on a ship with 600 passengers, and the dimensions of it, well, it was 180 feet long by 65 feet wide and 44 feet deep. That's big. But now many of you have been on cruise ships that are huge, several stories high. And I've never been on one. We hope to someday go on a cruise, but we've never done that as yet. And with, you know, a few years ago when they were having issues with it, I was thinking, man, I'm really glad I haven't gone on any cruises. I don't think I want to, you know, come up on the shore and, you know, kind of get stuck in the whatever it's called, or turn over or whatever. So anyway. But we do want to go on a cruise someday, right? Like to Alaska or something, right? I think she's thinking warm. I think you're right. And then he talks about the tongue and the body, you know. Tongue controlling the body or being affected by it. A strict application of this imagery suggests that we as believers similarly use the tongue to control the whole body. As one theologian pointed out, he says, we should make the application a little differently. Just as the bit determines the direction of the horse and the rudder the ship, so the tongue can determine the destiny of the individual. Last Sunday, we were in Lincoln City, and we got up in the morning and showered, and I turned the TV on, and Joel Osteen comes on the thing. I said, I'm going to listen to him because he gets a lot of criticism for this or that, the other thing. And I said, I want to listen to what he has to say. You know, I've never really heard much from him that I've really thought one way or the other about. I said, I'm going to listen closely to what he had to say. And I couldn't argue with anything he said, but here's what I want to tell you what he said that I think we need to really live by. We need to stop focusing on our history and focus on our destiny. Stop focusing on your history. Stop focusing on those things in your past and focus on what God has for you, your destiny. You know, and we see this. We need to allow the things that come our way. We need to allow our tongue to be used to promote our destiny, not to talk about our history. Another one he talks about is sparks and fire, and that's in verse 5. And we see James gearing up for a transition here. From verses 3 through 5, the first part of 5, which focuses on the disproportionate power of the tongue, to verses 6 through 8, which highlight their destructive power, okay? And Proverbs 16:27 compares the speech of a fool to a scorching fire. Okay, and another resource says that the tongue, Ecclesiastes 28:22, the tongue will not be master over the godly, and they will not be burned in its flame. And this word forest here, you know, he's talking about the forest, and it could refer to the brush that covered so many Palestinian hills. And which in that dry Mediterranean climate could easily and disastrously burst into flames. Remember what James told us back in chapter 1? In verse 9, he said we had two ears and one mouth. We need a timer between our brain and our mouth and our tongue. We need a timer, you know. If we would just simply pause and reflect on the immense disproportionate power of our tongues, maybe we could keep it caged up a little more frequently by being quick to hear and slow to speak. Proverbs 26:20, we would do well to heed what this says. Fire goes out without wood, and quarrels disappear when gossip stops. Number three, its destructive power, verses 6 through 8. Now, having identified the tongue with fire, James now moves to discuss the full destructive potential of the tongue. And in doing so, he gives 8 analogies about this destructive potential. And I'm just going to speak to a few of those analogies this morning. The first one he talks about, the tongue is a fire, which is a very appropriate analogy for the tongue. Just like fire, the tongue's sinful words can spread destruction very rapidly. Or as it's accompanying smoke, you know, our words can permeate and ruin everything around it. In 1871, during the week of October 8th through the 14th, it must have seemed like the whole world was ablaze for the residents in the upper Midwest. 4 of the world's worst fires, the worst fires in U.S. history, all broke out in the same week across the region. The Great Chicago Fire, which destroyed about a third of the city. At that time, it was estimated about $192 million. Can you imagine what it would be today? Left more than 100,000 residents homeless and 300 dead. That stole the headlines. But at the same time, 3 other fires also scorched the region. Blazes leveled the Michigan cities of Holland and Manistee in what has been referred to as the Great Michigan Fire, while across the state, another fire destroyed the city of Port Huron. But the worst fire of them all, however, might have been what was called the Great Peshtigo Fire. It was a firestorm that ravaged the Wisconsin countryside, leaving more than 1,500 people dead, the most fatalities by fire in U.S. history. Now, we recently saw the devastation down in the Santa Rosa area of California and how it just swept down through there. And I talked to a guy the other day who's from there, 4,000 homes just in the city of Santa Rosa. And then businesses on top of that, but 4,000 homes. And he showed pictures, and it was like, it's terrible. But can you imagine 1,500 people dying? You know, our words are the same. Embers of rumors, of half-truths, grumblings, sarcastic remarks, hurtful things said in the heat of anger, each with the potential to burn down acres of relationships and destroy others. John Calvin, in referring to the tongue, said that the tongue is a slender portion of flesh which contains the whole world of iniquity. That John Calvin quote was just for you, Derek. We were talking about John Calvin in our staff meeting this week. And this is what James means here. The tongue contains within it the sins of the fallen world. Now, how is this? What did Jesus say? Look at Matthew chapter 15, verse 10. He said, when he called the multitude to himself, he said to them, hear and understand. And then verses 18 through 20 says, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man. Then Proverbs 18:21 says, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits. 1 Peter 3:10 says, "For whoever desires to love life and sees good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit." Another analogy he talked about, that it was an untamable beast, which is the title of our teaching today. This reflects the fourfold order of creation. Sorry, I got behind. This reflects the fourfold order of creation of animal species in Genesis chapter 1. God gave mankind dominion over creation and power to subdue every species. You know, a power that since that time has been continually exercised. You know, there's an interesting note here. James in the Greek adds "of men" to the words "no one." And St. Augustine said, he does not say that no one can tame the tongue. He says, but no one of men can tame the tongue. So that when it is tamed, we confess that this is brought about by the pity, by the help, by the grace of Almighty God. Then he talked about the tongue being a restless evil. And restless translates the same Greek word that James used in chapter 1, verse 8, to describe the double-minded man who is unstable in all of his ways. As a modifier of evil, it likely means the evil is difficult to control. You know, he says, and J.B. Phillips' translation says, it's always liable to break out. And that perfectly describes my tongue. I don't know about you. Then he talked about the tongue being full of deadly poison. And that was the final description that he used. And it reflects Old Testament teaching out of Psalms 140, verse 3, that says that they make their tongue sharp as serpents and under their lips is the poison of vipers. You see, folks, the poison of our tongues produces the poison that our tongues produce destroys your neighbor. In Proverbs 11:9, and it brings the one who sins to ruin. Proverbs 10:8. Are you beginning to see the importance of working at controlling our tongue? Number four, its deplorable propensity. As a final climactic indictment of the tongue, James attributes to it what he calls, or what we're calling, a deplorable propensity. We have this propensity to say horrible things. Look at verse 9 of James chapter 3. "With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God." One commentator said it like this: to bless God is the sublimest function of the human tongue. Thrice daily, the devout Jews recited the 18 benedictions with their ending, "Blessed art thou, O God." See, we likewise bless God in prayer. This activity of blessing is cited by James as the highest, purest, and most noble form of speech. Now, the lowest and most filthiest and most ignoble form of speech, on the other hand, is cursing. You know, cursing in the ancient world, it wasn't just to swear at someone. It was the desire that they be cut off from God and experience eternal punishment. And Jesus prohibited the disciples from cursing others. He called them instead, as it's recorded in Luke 6:28, to bless those who curse you. So what makes cursing particularly heinous is that the one whom we pronounce damned has been made in the image of God. I don't know about you, but that hits me pretty hard. I mean, so flippantly we say things, and sometimes we talk about other people, or we say things about other people, but those people that we're talking about are made in the image of God. I used to have a pretty smart aleck way to talk to people who were cursing and who swore a lot. I would say something, and I was a real smart aleck kid. I'd say, well, man, do you eat out of that same mouth? Do you kiss your mama with that same mouth? You know? But how great a hypocrisy that we would bless God during a worship service, and then directly after the service, maybe in the Walmart parking lot or at our favorite restaurant, we curse someone who is made in God's image. We would do well to take to heart and be doers of the word and not just hearers of the word when it comes to our speech. Ephesians 4:29 says this: let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. If we all lived Ephesians 4:29, we would never have any problems in church, you know? We would never have any problems with anything. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace. Colossians 4:6 says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. And then James 3:10 says, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be. Like Jesus, James sees a person's speech for what it truly is, and that is a matter of the heart. This word comes out and proceed is the same Greek word that Jesus used in Matthew 15:11 and also in Matthew 18 that we read earlier. These things ought not to be. So we need to take Jesus' warning very seriously. Matthew 12, I'm going to give you some more scriptures here. Matthew 12, 36 and 37. But I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will give an account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Do you want to be justified by your words, or do you want to be condemned by your words? One commentator put it like this: the good set of mind does not talk from both sides of its mouth. Praises and curses, abuse and honor, calm and strife, hypocrisy and truth, poverty and wealth, but it has one disposition, uncontaminated and pure toward all men. James asserts incompatibility of pure heart and impure speech with three final illustrations. And each of these form a rhetorical question, expecting, I believe, an obvious no for an answer. Look at verses 11 and 12. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. The easy follow to all of this is there any justification for the corrupt, inconsistent, and an inconsistent pattern of speech? And the answer obviously is no. There is no justification for corrupt speech. To the person who speaks praises to God in the worship service and then abuses people verbally at home or at work, James commands this. He says, purify your speech throughout the week. With the person who says, oh, I know I talk too much, and kind of laughs it off, James is not amused. He insists, be quick to listen and slow to speak. By the person who boasts, well, I always speak my mind, no matter who gets hurt. Too many times they don't add that last part. They go, well, I always speak my mind, and they don't really care about whoever gets hurt. James is not impressed. He says, discipline your speaking. The person who says, I know I gossip too much, but I just can't help it. James still requires control your tongue. Of the person who is in the habit of speaking with insults or ridicule or sarcasm, James says, change your speech habits. He expects discipline to be happening in the life of a Christian. And that's exactly how it should be. If we call ourselves a follower of Jesus, we need to be able to say, I know that when I'm talking, I'm speaking the praises of God. And not saying bad things about other people, not cursing or lying or cheating or any of those things. Any Christian can ask for the grace needed, for God gives good gifts, and he gives them generously. We know that. There is then no justification for corrupt habits of speech in our churches today. It's just absolutely no justification for it. So I want to ask you in closing today, what is the number one cause of death in America today? Well, I believe it's heart disease. I believe that stat is still true. So let me ask, with that in mind, what does your tongue reveal about your heart this morning? What does your tongue reveal about your heart? Perhaps we need to have a heart transplant or a tongue transplant. I think that if we would purify our hearts, our tongues would be more apt to follow suit. What'd you hear today? Yes, what are you going to take with you today?